and to lose weight. If you went to a cardio class and the instructor forbade sweating, it would negate its purpose. Hard work naturally produces sweat, and sweat becomes evidence to your effort. Unfortunately, this ludicrous analogy is the paradox you face if you fear failure and refuse to release the brakes. The sweat of success is failure. While you can't build cardiovascular endurance without sweating, you can't experience success without failure. Failure is simply a natural response to success. If you avoid failure, you will also avoid success. You can't drive the road to wealth with the brakes engaged. You have to take risks. You have to get uncomfortable. You have to get out there and fail. So what causes this fear of failure? Fear of failure is attributed to an overestimation worst-case consequence analysis. What is the absolute worst that could happen and the probability of it happening? You fail at business and you have to go back to work? Big deal. When you resist societal headwinds, you will sweat. Take calculated risks. Do so and things happen. You meet new people. New opportunities arise. Feedback pours in. Lucky breaks converge into your life. The act of doing does marvelous things. Yes, the fast lane is a risk. Failure is imminent. I learned how to code computers by trial and failure. I'd fail a code block hundreds of times before I found the right way to do something. My other failures ranged from moronic multi-level marketing programs to jewelry to direct marketing programs. Each time I brushed it off, reanalyzed, learned, adjusted, and tried again. I once heard, a smart man learns from his mistakes. A wise man learns from the mistakes of others. You can learn from my failures. I didn't learn the fast lane overnight. I fought it by the light of failure. Fear of failure is normal, yet failure creates experience, and experience breeds wisdom. Fast lane risks can have lifelong returns. Bill Gates is a one-hit wonder. He built one company and made billions. One company was all it took. Some might say, I'm a one-hit wonder. Great. I'd rather be a one-hit wonder than a no-hit wonder. One hit is all it takes, and you can be set up for life. You have a challenge. If you want to hit home runs, you got to get up to the plate and swing. Home runs or singles can't be hit sitting on your butt in the dugout or sitting on the couch eating pretzels while killing grunts on Halo 3. Get up to the plate and start swinging. Start striking out. After enough swings and acclimating yourself to the velocity of business, contact becomes easier. Take intelligent risks and skip the moronic ones. When it comes to risk analysis, there are two types of risk designated by best and worst case outcomes or consequences: intelligent risks and moronic risks. Flying to Las Vegas and gambling a month's salary at the craps table is a moronic risk. Driving a car on the freeway with faulty brakes is a moronic risk. When you take intelligent risks and avoid the moronic ones, you amplify your wealth trajectory through time. Intelligent risks have a limited downside, while their upside is unlimited. Moronic risks have a bottomless downside, while their upside is limited or short-term. Most moronic risks fall into the asymptomatic category. They simply aren't clearly defined, and it takes a little diligence to spot them. When I'm out racing on the streets of Phoenix in an 850-horsepower car, I'm engaged in an asymptomatic, moronic risk. My upside is a short-term burst of adrenaline and a temporary ego boost. The downside is crashing and killing myself or someone else. The upside is limited and short. The downside is unlimited and long. Yes, it just seems so idiotic. Here's another moronic risk, and it took me this chapter to uncover it. I'm writing this book on a cloud computing application. That means I'm writing to an external source or an external server. I have not made copies of my work. If the cloud server fails, my work is gone. Yes, moronic risks come in all sizes and flavors, and this makes me the idiot of the day. Excuse me while I go back up my work. Okay, I'm back. Now let's talk about intelligent risks. When I invest $100,000 in an internet company, I'm engaging in an intelligent risk. When I sold my internet company, I reinvested part of the proceeds back into the company. I still own a very minor percentage, and it's completely passive. Now, why did I invest $100,000 and expose myself to the risk? I assessed the acquiring company's probability of success to be high. Their goal was to take my small company and transform it into a $100 million company. If they succeed, my small $100,000 investment would then be worth upside to $2 million. The downside? The company could fail and the liquidation value of my investment would lose about 50%. My downside is limited, while the upside is substantial. This is an intelligent risk. If you quit your job to engage in a fast-lane business, it's an intelligent risk. Your upside could be millions. The downside? You might have to live below your standards. Mop floors, flip burgers, eat rice and beans, or ride your bike to the grocery store. Now, is that really that bad? Not if you know your destination and your commitment to the roadmap. Again, it all comes down to what you are willing to do and not willing to do. Risk involves careful stewardship of choice. Minimize moronic risk and take advantage of intelligent risk. As for the failure, trust me, it is easier to live in regret of failure than in regret of never trying. Smack someday. What prevents people from hitting the red line? Someday does. Someday I will, someday I'll do this, someday I'll do that, and someday when the kids are grown, someday when the debts are paid, someday, someday, someday. And yet, someday never comes. Someday is a distant horizon in the theater of your mind. Someday is dangerous and paralyzing. It traps you in the land of Nowheresville. Sunday is here, now, pristine and clean and begging no allegiance for tomorrow. The Fastlane petitions you for this simple transformation. Make someday today. Ever drive somewhere and all the traffic lights are green? Unfortunately, when it comes to opportunity and risk minimization, people wait for the perfect timing. They wait for all the lights to go green, which summons the somedays. Ask anyone seeking a slow lane escape. Why haven't you made the leap? What are you waiting for? It's always some excuse. I'm waiting for a promotion. I'm waiting for the kids to be older. I'm waiting to be debt-free. I'm waiting for the new year. I'm waiting to finish school. I'm waiting for the wife to get a job. I'm waiting for the economy to turn around. I'm waiting until I fix the hot water heater. I'm waiting for this. I'm waiting for that. The common thread is always the same. I'm waiting. But waiting for what? Someday. Someday for something, some event, or some precondition. Sadly, these mentally constructed provisions come and go, leaving the opportunity seeker stuck in the same rut for years. Waiting for all the lights to go green is like waiting for the skies to turn purple on the third Wednesday in November. Let me be clear if I haven't been. There is never a perfect time. Someday is today. Today is now. A week is 7 todays strung together, while a year is 365. Today is all you've got, and if you wait, opportunity passes. Your fast lane journey never starts, and year after year passes with new preconditions being added while the old ones are satisfied. While opportunity passes, guess what else passes? Time. Yep, ring up the cheesy soap opera music. As time passes, so do the sands of your life, and these are the days of our lives. Opportunity doesn't care about timing. Opportunity drives through your neighborhood frequently, and when it does, you have to grab that bitch. Evaluate the risk and take action. Unfortunately, opportunity doesn't care about your timing. Opportunity doesn't care about your circumstances, your broken-down car, or your life's turmoil. It comes and goes on its own will, has a mind of its own, and is blind to predicaments. Opportunity comes dressed as changes and challenges. Remember, change makes millionaires. The Fastlane Forum, thefastlaneforum.com, is my example of seizing opportunity outside of my desired timing. My forum existed years before this book was written because opportunity drove through my neighborhood unannounced. My preconceived timing for the Fastlane Forum was after my book's completion. However, years before the first word was written, I revisited a business forum I had once frequented. I recognized familiar forum contributors lamenting about the old days and how hucksters had invaded the forum, people pimping their spams, schemes, and scams. It was a blooming garden of flowers that had become overrun by weeds. People demanded change or an alternative. In my mind, I had a forum coming at some point in the undefined future. But this opportunity was not coming at my convenience. Opportunity suddenly turned the corner and I heard its deafening exhaust. Even though I was in the shower, I got out, ran outside soaking wet, unprepared, premature, and met the opportunity. I greeted it, opened the door, and let it inside. Not in my time, but in opportunity's time, and someday became today. That decision allowed me to pre-sell hundreds of books before the first word was written. Many of the world's successful entrepreneurs started businesses in college. You know their companies, Microsoft, Dell, FedEx, Facebook. Their founders seized opportunity outside of their timing and chose to take an intelligent risk. These entrepreneurs captured opportunity and didn't wait for satisfaction of preconditions. Oh, after I graduate, or on summer break, or after the Math 202 exam. Opportunities are dressed as unfilled needs, and when they ring your doorbell, you have to answer it. Unanswered opportunity leaves and rings another doorbell, knowing eventually somebody willing will answer. So why not you? Timing is rarely perfect. Waiting empowers mediocrity. People sit around waiting their entire lives for the perfect this and the perfect that. The perfect scenarios and circumstances never arrive. What does arrive? Time, old age, and the specter of a dream lost. And now you have the opportunity to get out of the garage and take the road. The road is where your fast lane journey starts. Fast lane roads lead to wealth. You have the fast lane roadmap, and you know how the slow lane and the sidewalk operate. You know how to tune your vehicle. You know which mindsets are assets and which are liabilities. You've exposed the gravitational forces that will conspire against your vehicle. You have all the necessary tools to get out of the garage and get on one of the many roads to wealth. Yes, it is time to hit the road. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Interest is first gear. Commitment is the red line. Hard work and commitment separates the winners from losers. Some choose short-term mediocre comfort over long-term meteoric comfort. To live unlike everyone else, you have to do what everyone else won't. Arm your expectations to hard work, sacrifice, and other bumps in the road. These are the landmines where the weak are removed from the road and sent back to the land of most people. Failure is natural to success. Expect it and learn from it. One home run could set you up financially secure for the rest of your life, perhaps generations. Home runs cannot be hit in the dugout. Moronic risks have unlimited downside long-term and limited upside short-term. Intelligent risks have unlimited upside long-term and limited downside short-term. There is never perfect timing, and waiting for someday just wastes time. Part 7, The Roads to Wealth. Chapter 29, The Right Road, Routes to Wealth. He who chooses the beginning of the road chooses the place it leads to. It is the means that determines the end. Henry Emerson Fosdick. Is your road to wealth a dead end? What is the road to wealth as it relates to your wealth journey? If you're a slow laner, your road is a job, doctor, lawyer, engineer, salesman, hairdresser, or pilot. If you're a fast laner, your road is a business, internet entrepreneur, real estate investor, author, inventor. Your road is your career or business path, and that road must route to wealth. Unfortunately, most jobs can't route to wealth because of their mathematical limitations, and surprisingly, most businesses don't either. A road that starts in Chicago and leads east will never hit Las Vegas. It's a dead end. If you're on an errant business road, you have to use your steering wheel and make a course correction. Exit the road, take a turn, or turn around. This impasse confronts millions of business owners. They fool themselves by journeying the wrong road and then wonder why wealth has eluded them. Instead of fighting 8-hour workdays, they fight 12-hour store hours. Instead of leveraging the surrogacy of a system, they trade time for dollars. Instead of trading 5 days of work for 2 days off, they trade 6 for 1 or 7 for 0 in lifelong perpetuity. If you heed the fast lane philosophy and start a lemonade stand on the street corner simply because Fastlane said, start a business, I've failed. That road is the wrong road because it doesn't route to wealth. The road to wealth must route to wealth. How? Your road must go through or near the law of affection. The Road to Affection, the Five Fastlane Commandments. The law of affection says, to make millions, you must impact millions. How can you impact millions? In the slow lane, you explode intrinsic value, become enormously indispensable, and earn millions. In the fast lane, you engineer a business that touches millions of lives in scale, or many lives of magnitude. If your road doesn't lead to affection's neighborhood, or you have an off-ramp onto it, sorry, you're on the wrong road. The power of the fast lane wealth equation is ignited by a business that drives to the law of affection. Business opportunities are plentiful, and unfortunately, most of them aren't fast lane roads. If you're stuck in a retail store selling $10 haircuts, can you reasonably expect to serve millions? To make millions, you must serve millions. A kick-butt attitude is negated if your road is directionally challenged toward affection, because affection is the gatekeeper to wealth. To light the law of affection and illuminate your fast lane road, cross-examine it against the five fast lane commandments, which we pronounced next. Number 1, the commandment of need. Number 2, the commandment of entry. Number 3, the commandment of control. Number 4, the commandment of scale. Number 5, the commandment of time. The next commandments are a fast lane litmus test, and they validate your road. Does your road or your potential road route to wealth? Is it fast lane? Can it be made fast lane? Can it hit affection? Can your road route to a multi-million dollar enterprise, generate passive income, and end at a final liquidation event? A road meeting all five commandments can make you filthy rich. As violations accrue, the road degrades in its wealth potential, and with it, your ability to get near affection also degrades. While it's possible to violate one or more commandments and still create wealth quickly, you should aim for a road that satisfies all five commandments. Potent roads are potent wealth creators. Sadly, most business opportunities fail the commandments, and if they fail, they don't deserve your respect or attention. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. Not all businesses are the right road. Few roads move at, through, or near the law of affection. The best and the purest fast lanes satisfy the five fast lane commandments: need, entry, control, scale, and time. Chapter 30, The Commandment of Need. What do we live for if not to make life less difficult for each other? George Eliot. Sand foundations crumble houses. 90% of all new businesses fail within the first 5 years, and I know why they fail. They fail because they fail the commandment of need. The commandment of need. When you build a business based on a flawed foundation, it's going to fail. Sand foundations crumble houses. Businesses that violate the commandment of need either belong to the 90% failure category or masquerade as a job. Gravity cannot be defied, and the winning premise of business is a simple yet often forgotten principle by most business owners. Businesses that solve needs win. Businesses that provide value win. Businesses that solve problems win profits. Selfish, narcissistic motives do not make good long-term business models. Now think about the purpose of business. Why do they exist? To satisfy your selfish desire to do what you love? To satisfy your craving for wealth and financial freedom? Seriously, no one cares about your desires, your dreams, your passions, and your whys and your reasons for wanting to be rich. No one cares that you want to own a Ferrari and prove your parents wrong. No one cares that corporate America wronged you. No one cares. Yes, the world is a selfish place, and nobody gives two craps about your motives to go fast lane. So what do people care about? People care about what can your business do for them? How will it help them? What's in it for them? Will it solve their problem? Make their life easier? Provide them with shelter? Save them money? Educate them? Make them feel something? Tell me, why on God's green earth should I give your business money? What value are you adding to my life? Reflect back to our producer-consumer dichotomy. Consumers are selfish. They demand to know, what's in it for me? To succeed as a producer, you have to surrender your own selfishness and address the selfishness of others. Stop chasing money. Chase needs. Never start a business just to make money. Stop chasing money and start chasing needs. Let me repeat that because it's probably the most important thing in this book. Stop thinking about business in terms of your selfish desires, whether it's money, dreams, or do what you love. Instead, chase needs, problems, pain points, service deficiencies, and emotions. Entrepreneurs fail because they create businesses based on selfish premises, and selfish premises don't yield profitable businesses. They lead directly into the 90% failure wastebasket.
I need a new income stream. I'm an expert in blank, so I'll do that. I read a Get Rich book, and it says to start a business.
Wrong, wrong, and wrong. Again, selfish, narcissistic premises are VIP invitations to violate the commandment of need. You and your business attract money when you stop being selfish and turn your business's focus from the needs of yourself to the needs of other people. Give first and take second. Needs come first, not money. Needs precede money. Engage the marketplace with your own selfish need, and my bet is placed on your failure.
Joe was a martial arts expert, and he loved his craft. Following the advice of gurus, he set out to do what you love and opened up a martial arts studio. Within 10 months, his studio closed as he could no longer support his family on a $21,000 per year business profit.
Before Joe started, he was destined for failure. He got into business based on a faulty entrepreneurial road paved with sand, a premise based on selfish needs and selfish desires. Oh, I'm an expert in martial arts and I love the art. Therefore, I should open a studio. The correct foundation is externally based on needs in the market, not on internal selfish needs. Instead of selfish motives, what should have Joe really been thinking? Is there a need in my neighborhood for a martial arts studio? What are the existing martial arts studios doing wrong that I could do better? What improved value do I offer the martial arts student? What assets do I bring to this community? Joe failed because there wasn't a genuine need in the marketplace, and his motives were selfish. Had Joe analyzed these questions foremost, his odds of driving a successful road would have dramatically improved. Several years ago, during the economic expansion, I noticed a standalone storefront being built in my mother's neighborhood of Chandler, Arizona, a white, middle-class suburb of Phoenix. As the building went up and the store tenant moved in, the heat of failure percolated. How did I know? This new store was a hip-hop apparel boutique. Now fasten your seatbelt because here comes failure. Why? The store violates the commandment of need. The neighborhood doesn't need a hip-hop store. The area isn't urban, there's no dance clubs nearby, and nothing looks remotely hip-hop. In fact, not 100 yards away, there's an elder care retirement home. Is a 91-year-old grandpa the target market for hip-hop gear? The obvious problem here is selfishness. The owner is following his passions and his love for hip-hop music and culture. Maybe a life coach told him to do what you love. Whatever the motive, the need is internal and not externally based on the marketplace. I predicted the business would last a year. After 18 months, the business disappeared. The road was paved with sand because no need existed. Money chasers chase money, not needs. Frequently, I read a lot of posts from aspiring entrepreneurs with grandiose goals of making a fortune by starting a business. Hang out at any business forum, and you will see the misdirected, selfish foundation poisoning the well. How can I make money starting a business? What business can I start with $200 and make $5,000 a month? What home-based business can I start? I have a friend who manufactures widgets. You think I can make money selling them? How can I make a good passive income? What's a good product to sell on eBay? What's the best business to start on a shoestring? If you sit around and ask yourself these types of questions, you'll likely end up in the failure category because these dialogues expose your preoccupation with money, not needs or value. You've got it backwards. I call these entrepreneurs money chasers. They hop from one business to the next, scalping and arbitraging market imbalances, rarely solving needs or creating momentum. Sometimes these selfish business owners use questionable business practices as customer needs are neglected and money is pursued with reckless abandon. Money chasers are consumers who haven't quite made the transition to producer. They want to be producers, but they selfishly think like consumers. For example, in the housing boom, money chasers became mortgage brokers and real estate agents. The burst of the bubble purged the industry clean of the excess. Now with foreclosures at an all-time high, loan modifiers are the newest money chasers. Every boom and bust brings forth the money chasers who are selfishly motivated to hop aboard a train of trends, but are in business solely to serve themselves. With plenty of selfish consumers to prey upon, money chasers survive and thrive until the next bust, or they're exposed for fraud. In times of excess, scams, schemes, and rip-offs pervade because money chasers invade and imbalances are created. To attract money is to forget money. Want to make big bucks? Then start attracting money instead of chasing it. Money's like a mischievous cat. If you chase it around the neighborhood, it eludes you. It hides up a tree, behind the rose bush, or in the garden. However, if you ignore it and focus on what attracts the cat, it comes to you and sits right in your lap. Money isn't attracted to selfish people. It is attracted to businesses that solve problems. It's attracted to people who fill needs and add value, solve needs massively, and money massively attracts. The amount of money in your life is merely a reflection of the amount of value you have given to others. Ignore this symbiosis and money will ignore you. Successful businesses share one common trait, the satisfaction of consumer needs as reflected by sales in the marketplace. The marketplace and consumers, not you, determine if your business is viable. If you sell 10 million anything, 10 million people have voted that your product will help them or satisfy one of their needs. The only fast lane road that works is a road paved with cement, rock-hard needs, wants, and solutions, not sand. A rock-hard pavement gives you the unfair odds. Solve needs on a massive scale or in magnitude. It could be as fantastic as starting a software company like Bill Gates did, or something seemingly minute like putting a new spin on something old. If you own a website that services 10,000 people a day, you're making an impact. If you own a real estate company that provides housing to 1,000 people, you're making an impact. Make a freaking impact and start providing value. Let money come to you. Look outside the world, stop being selfish, and help your fellow humans solve their problems. In a world of selfishness, become unselfish. Need something more concrete? No problem. Make 1 million people achieve any of the following, and I guarantee you will be worth millions. Make them feel better. Help them solve a problem. Educate them. Make them look better, health, nutrition, clothing, or makeup. Give them security, housing, safety, health. Raise a positive emotion, love, happiness, laughter, self-confidence. Satisfy appetites from basic food to the risque, sexual. Make things easier. Enhance their dreams and give hope. So the next time you're trolling the web looking to make money, sit back and ask yourself, what do I have to offer the world? Offer the world value and money becomes magnetized to you. Do what you love and die as you do. Beware of another guru speak. Do what you love and the money will follow. Bullshit. That is, unless you want to violate the commandment of need. Do what you love is another mythical decree perpetrated by hypocritical gurus and so-called life coaches who are probably 3 clients away from broke. Sadly, the road of do what you love rarely converges with wealth. In fact, it might lead you down a road to destructive love. If you're like me, do what you love was never an option. Think about what you love and then think, is someone going to pay you for it? Is it going to solve a need? Are you good enough to make money doing it? Most likely you aren't. For do what you love to work, you need two things. Number one, your love must solve a need. And number two, you must be exceptional at it. For example, I love to play basketball, but frankly, I suck at it. I can't parlay my love of basketball into a career. I also love to play piano, but again, I suck at it. I love many things, but I suck at them. If I wanted a career in any of these loves, I need unlimited time and money because no one would pay me a dime to do it. Who wants to endure that kind of ineptness? Consider this book. I love to write. This book represents a dream of doing what I love, and that dream was made possible by the fast lane. If I needed this book to pay for my mortgage, I'm not sure it would. I have no clue if this book will sell 10 copies or 10 million. Therefore, I can't rely on it. Doing what you love for money often isn't good enough because we aren't good enough. Additionally, so many people are doing what they love that the marketplace for that activity is so crowded and margins become depressed and heavy competition reigns. Authoring a book is a crowded space. Just because I love to write doesn't guarantee money will follow. In fact, no one cares that I love to write. Do you? Of course not. You want to know if my writing will help you. In a magazine interview, billionaire R.J. Kirk was asked about the benchmark to his success. He replied, "It is for others to say whether I'm useful or not. It isn't for you to decide whether you are useful. The marketplace makes that determination. People pay for their satisfaction. They don't pay to satisfy your need of do what you love. People pay for solutions, not for your enjoyment. People pay for solved problems. People don't give a dirty dog butt about your love for whatever. If do what you love doesn't fill a need spectacularly, no one's going to pay for it. This book is possible because I didn't need the confirmation of money to authenticate my skill." If that sentence is not too complicated to understand, you get my point. Maybe I'm just not good enough. Regardless of sales, my book is a testament to do what I love, whether I'm good at it or not. The fast lane allowed money to be removed from the equation. Now I don't need to get paid to do what I love, I just do it. In other words, money led do what you love, it didn't follow. Now how's that for irony? LeBron James gets paid to play basketball because he is good. One of the many destinations of the fast lane is to remove the confirmation of money from your do-what-you-love activity. Fastlane success means I could play basketball 7 days a week. I could play video games all day. I don't need to get paid to do what I love because now I can do it for free. If you are one of the lucky few who can earn an income from a specific activity that you love and are good enough, kudos to you. And congratulations, you may not even need a fast lane. A slow lane just might suffice. No worries. But for those of us who can't transform our loves into income, there are other alternatives paved by the fast lane. Doing what you love, fakes and derivatives. If you can't work a job or a business doing what you love, you're likely to fall into a trap. Your natural reaction is to make a deal with the devil, the slow lane. You trade your life away doing things you hate in exchange for doing things you love. You say, "I'll do 5 days of work I hate so I can enjoy 2 weekend days doing something I love." Does this barter sound like rational thinking? For example, my friend Andy is a bank collections agent and hates his job. At beer time, I hear the complaints, the frustration, and the BS about the job, the Nazi-like micromanagement, the incompetent boss and his psychotic co-workers. He's on the firing line from all fronts. He numbs himself to this suffering 5 days a week. His salvation? His weekend. He pays do what you hate with a weekend of boating, which is his do what you love. Then other people negotiate with do what you love into an alternative or a derivative. For example, Jose loves automotive audio, so he opens a car stereo shop. Janice loves to sculpt and sells her work at the local gallery. Gary is an avid bodybuilder, so he becomes a personal trainer. There are two dangers to derivatives. Number one, they don't make money fast, and number two, they endanger the love. First, Do what you love rarely creates money fast because more than likely not only are you doing what you love, but thousands of others love doing the same thing too. I mean, just turn into the first week auditions for American Idol for proof. The need is weak, and this saturates markets and makes profit margins shallow. At my gym, a personal trainer acquaintance told me he's struggling to make ends meet. When I asked why, he responded that personal training is so competitive that he can't charge a price worth his time. His service fees are deflationary, caused by an abundant supply of trainers, and when supply exceeds demand or need, prices move down. Not enough need, too much supply. So why is the field for personal trainers so saturated? Simple. People follow the espoused guru-esque advice without reflection on need. Do what you love. Unfortunately, if you love doing it, bet on thousands of others who also love doing it. When you do what you love, prepared to face stiff competition. Who enjoys higher margins, the personal trainer or the guy who starts a company to clean up crime scenes? The second danger of derivatives is that your love becomes vulnerable to contamination when you do it for money. If you are forced to do anything, even something you purport to love in exchange for a paycheck, that love is put in danger. Years ago, I took a job as a limo driver because I loved to drive. By the time the job ended, I hated to drive. After work, I'd stay home because I was so sick of driving. My love was contaminated. I once had a friend who created fantastic paintings as a hobby. When I asked her why she doesn't paint full-time for a living, her answer was simple. I paint when I am impassioned to paint. The few times when she painted for money, it stunted her artistic creativity because a different force fueled the motivation. Money, not emotion from the moment. Do what you love is left to professional athletes because they're at the pinnacle of their games. And yet, even after making millions, many of these athletes suffer the same fate. They lose their love of the game. Dancers lose their love of dance. Artists lose their love for art. Money and the demands of life cast a cloud over the love and darken it into a burden. While derivatives of do what you love might yield a figment of happiness, they operate in saturated marketplaces, and more importantly, they could jeopardize your natural love for the activity. Your ignition, moving from love to passion. The motivational fuel for the fast lane is passion, not love. Passion gets you out of the garage and onto the road. If you have a passion for a specific goal, you will do anything for it. I had a passion for Lamborghinis, and I was willing to do anything for it. Pick up dog shit, mop floors, work at 3 in the morning, whatever it was going to take, I had the passion to do it. Did I love driving limos? Hell no. But I had a fast lane passion, and it motivated my movement to the vision of the future. Your vehicle needs an ignition, a starter, something that compels you to jump out of bed in the morning, challenged to tackle the day. That ignition is passion. You need a passion for something greater. It is different for everybody, but when you find it, you will do anything for it. When you reposition your goals and visions at the end of a road that works, that end transforms your daily life into passionate action toward that specified destination. If you can't get paid doing some specific activity, identify a specific why or end goal that ignites your passion to act. What is your why? Why are you doing this? Why go fast lane? What are your reasons? Whom do you want to prove wrong? What exactly are your whys? My whys read like this. I want to pay off my mother's mortgage. I want to wake up without an alarm clock. I want to write a book without the pressure of money. I want a big house on a mountainside with a pool. I want a Lamborghini. I want to make a difference. I want to prove him wrong. Passion beats do what you love because passion fuels motivation for something greater than yourself and is often generalized. When the focus is doing what you love, the focus becomes industry specific and you're likely to violate the commandment of need. Why are you starting this business? Because you love it or because there is a real market need for it? I repeat, passion for an end goal, a why, drives fast lane action. Mike Rowe, host of the cable show Dirty Jobs, profiled several owners of businesses who had less than lovable duties. From testing bovine manure to cleaning up pigeon goop, the owners were passionate. None of them loved what they did, but they had a passionate why and a very deep bank account. Competition was sparse because everyone else was chasing do what you love. A formidable why is all you need to turn your daily activities into passionate motivation. The get up in the morning metamorphosis to bust open a fast lane road. What are your whys, and are they strong enough to motivate you into process? Passion erases the suffering of work. When I was in startup mode with my business, I worked long hours. Was I suffering the toil of work? Nope, I enjoyed it, because I had my whys and I was moving toward them. The journey hardened me, challenged me, and yes, it was even fun. I was passionate about what I wanted and I was going to get it. The fast lane isn't a destination, but a personal journey. Writing this book has been an enduring journey, and I admit I gave up 3 times. Why? After a year of writing and not finishing, my love for writing evaporated. My love became a hate. I was doing what I love, and suddenly that love faded because people started to expect a book. I confided to a friend, I quit. I no longer enjoy it, and I don't need to finish it. So how did I finish if my love for writing evaporated? I found my passion, which compelled me to finish. I love to see the dreams of others become reality. When a dead dream is given sudden life, I feel invigorated. Anytime I wanted to give up, I'd receive an email that applauded me. Your forum changed my life, or thank you, my life has really turned around. That is passionate currency that repositioned my writing effort into action. I went from love to suffering to passion. Get your road to converge with a fantastic dream. A road that doesn't converge with your dreams is a dead end. When you concede dreams, life withers. Reflect back to childhood when you heard, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" Underneath this question, what's it really asking? It's a probe to find the road to your dreams, and it usually is answered in a phantasmal vision. For me, I wanted to be an astronaut, blame Han Solo, a filmmaker, blame George Lucas, and an author, blame Isaac Asimov. So how about you? What is your outrageous, fantastic dream? And the real question of concern, is there any chance you are doing it or will be doing it? More than likely, you're not, because the slow lane has killed it. I asked my friend Rick this question. Guess what? He didn't answer the question with, "I want to be a sales representative at Verizon Wireless." Nope. He answered with, "I want to be a race car driver." So then, why is Rick selling cell phones today? Is there any chance in hell he will actually become his dream, a race car driver? There isn't. The dream is dead and the road is derelict. Nonetheless, as Rick sticks to his job and waits for a promotion, he wonders, there's got to be more than this. And then there's Sarah. She didn't answer this question with, "I want to be a shift manager at Taco Bell." Nope, she wanted to be an artist. But today, Sarah finds herself working the graveyard shift, mopping up floors in the dining room from slobs who have mistaken sour cream for finger paint. As she slams the mop head in the wringer, Sarah has a moment of disquiet. Is this what my life has become? The problem with these people is not their jobs. We've all had crappy, embarrassing jobs that we hate. The problem is their dead-end road that will never converge with a dream. Dreams are forsaken to pay the bills. Instead of a convergent road to dreams or a chance of a dream, their road goes to an inescapable hell. Life becomes suffering. There is nothing wrong with working at Verizon or Taco Bell. Heck, these jobs would have been promotions in comparison to the meaningless jobs I've held. But please, don't make these jobs your means to the end, your final road, because the end most likely will never come. You see, if your dream is dead, so is your passion. No passion numbs you to the greatest violinist in the world while he plays in the train depot. No passion leads to mediocrity and the land of everybody. If you're struggling for motivation, re-energize your dream and align it with a road capable of burning a trail to its reality. Dead dreams can't burn trails of passion. Passion fires your will to do what is necessary beyond what others can't. Fastlaners work unlike everyone else so they can live unlike everyone else. Take 4 years of hard work in exchange for 40 years of freedom. Unfortunately, most people take 40 years of hard work for 4 weeks of freedom, or however long their paid vacation lasts. Find your snow in the toilet. How do you find your passion? Passion comes from excitement or discontent. Take this story posted on the Fastlane forum.
I grew up in a poor family and lived in a very old run-down barn that had half of it converted into a home. One of the worst times of the year was winter because our water pipes would freeze, and with it, our running water. The only way to flush the toilet was to bring snow into the barn, pack it into the water tank behind the toilet, and wait for it to melt. I saw that my mom had to put snow in the tank of the toilet bowl just for us to flush. The worst part, that it had to be refilled every time someone used the toilet. I thought to myself, I never want to live like this again.
What is your passion, your perennial snow in the toilet?
Leslie Walburn is passionate about animals. Disillusioned by county-owned shelters that euthanize dogs, her dream is to own a no-kill dog rescue shelter. While she can do what she loves and get a job at a shelter, it doesn't bring her closer to her dreams, nor will a job help her amass the wealth needed to pursue the dream. Yes, dog shelters are expensive. Instead, Leslie allows her passion to fuel her motivation. She starts a fast lane business, unrelated to animals, that eventually funds her dream. Her passion leads to a dream without the crucible of money.
Reflect on a time when your life was turned upside down with excitement and or discontent. That is your passion. For me, excited passion was when I saw my first Lamborghini as a teenager, and I decided, one day I will own a Lamborghini. For me, discontented passion was watching my mother struggle in dead-end jobs trying to raise 3 kids without a husband. Both fueled my passion. I wanted a Lamborghini, and I wanted to help ease the burden for my mother. Excitement, wants, and desires serves as passionate fuel, as does discontent, undesirable situations. Both allowed me to do what others wouldn't. And if you find yours too, you will too. Chapter Summary, Fast Lane Distinctions. The Commandment of Need states that businesses that solve needs win. Needs can be pain points, service gaps, unsolved problems, or emotional disconnects. 90% of all new businesses fail because they are based on selfish internal needs, not external market needs. No one cares about your selfish desires for dreams or money. People only want to know, what can your business do for them? Money chasers haven't broken free from selfishness, and their businesses often follow their own selfish needs. People vote for your business with their money. Chase money and it will elude you. However, if you ignore it and focus on what attracts money, you will draw it to yourself. Help 1 million people and you will be a millionaire. For money to follow, do what you love. Your love must solve a need and you must be exceptional at it. Do what you love sets the stage for crowded marketplaces with depressed margins. When you have the financial resources, you can do what you love and not get paid for it, nor do you have to be good at it. Slow laners feed do what you love and do what you hate. 5 days of hate for 2 days of love. Doing what you love for money can endanger your love. Passion for an end goal, a why, drives fast lane success. Having a passionate why can transform work into joy. Doing what you love usually leads to the violation of the commandment of need. The right road for you is one that will converge with your dreams. Chapter 31, The Commandment of Entry. Our plans miscarry because they have no aim. When a man does not know what harbor he is making for, no wind is the right wind. Seneca. You can be the sheep or the sheep herder. It was 1994 and I was stuffed in a hot auditorium, tucked away in a chaotic mass of people, an ant submersed in an anthill. Months earlier, I had become involved in a network marketing company, and this was their monthly motivational meeting. The crowd was excited, anxious, and revved up. I wasn't. I looked around and saw a problem. I saw an army of drones clutching onto whatever was said, critical reasoning cast aside, and myself about to be indoctrinated. I didn't go easy. I asked questions. I was persistent, nosy, and curious about the road I was about to take. How much money are you making? I asked early and often. But like politicians, the answer was sideswiped and deflected to a default person in the organization. But I wasn't fooled. Okay, you've already told me that Bill Hansen is making $30,000 a month, but how much do you make? And you, and you, and the other 3,000 people in this room? The fact is, few of them made any money at all. Why? They were stuck driving a congested road full of traffic that failed the commandment of entry. Crowded, jammed roads move slowly, if at all. Commandment of entry. I failed network marketing 4 times because subconsciously I possessed the truth. The road was a violation of the commandment of entry. The commandment of entry states that as entry barriers to any business road fall or lessen, the effectiveness of that road declines while competition in that field subsequently strengthens. Higher entry barriers equate to stronger, more powerful roads with less competition and less need for exceptionality. Lower barrier entry businesses are weak roads because easy entry creates high competition and high traffic, all of which share the same pie. And where there is traffic, there is no movement. In other words, if getting into business is as simple as paying $200 for a distributor kit, there are no entry barriers and the opportunity should be passed. If any Joe Blow napping behind Chan's Chinese restaurant in the alley next to the dumpster can start your business in minutes, it isn't a business you want to be doing. The world is littered with so-called businesses that have no entry barriers, and that is why they suck, and the people who follow them aren't rich. A decade ago, the big buzz was, make millions on eBay. It didn't last long because this opportunity eventually violated the commandment of entry. If you could create a business on eBay in 10 minutes, guess what? So could millions of other people. And who made the millions? The early adopters, eBay and eBay's founders. They drove the fast lane and picked up millions of hitchhikers along the way. Few did well, while millions did not. The big buzz just months ago was internet blogging. Bloggers are making thousands. True, but nowadays the multimillionaire blogger is now the exception rather than the rule. Why? The opportunity has been beaten down by ease of entry, causing traffic, competition, and saturation. Saturation causes noise. Noise causes declining sales volumes. Declining sales volumes cause profit erosion. If anyone can start a business in 1 day or less doing what you do, you probably are violating the commandment of entry, and tough odds are ahead. Network marketing or multi-level marketing, MLM, always fails the commandment of entry, unless you own and create the MLM company yourself. If you're in a room with 2,000 other people who do exactly what you do, you're fighting stiff odds. Who is the innovator, the leader, and the one standing on the cliff parting the Red Sea? The guy on the stage who founded the MLM company is the Fastlaner. And you? Sorry, but you're just another soldier in his Fastlane army, a cog in his marketing strategy. The MLM founder doesn't need to climb the pyramid because he built the pyramid. You could be the pyramid climber or the pyramid builder, or you can be the sheep or the sheep herder. Exceptionalism is required to overcome weak entry. If you violate the commandment of entry, be prepared to be exceptional. Exceptionality breaks the odds of entry. Unfortunately, exceptionality is a long shot, much like an above-average high school athlete going pro. For example, when I sat in that auditorium with thousands of other network marketers, I realized that to exceed among thousands doing the same thing, I had to be exceptional. I had to be the best. Honest with myself, I knew I couldn't be exceptional in that construct. Could I be the exceptional one among 50,000 like-minded distributors? I was doubtful. Conversely, when I started my internet business, I had roughly 12 competitors. Could I be exceptional among 12? Absolutely. Another example of exceptionality is playing professional poker and financial trading, like stocks, futures, and currency trading. Both disciplines violate entry and have little to no restrictions to access. I can go to Vegas with $10,000 and enter a poker tournament anytime I want. I can deposit $10,000 in a trading account and start trading currency. Lack of entry itself creates the marketplace, and to succeed in that marketplace, you have to be exceptional. The best and the richest poker players in the world are exceptional and take advantage of the weakest lured by weak entry. The pros call these folks dead money. The same playing field exists in the currency markets. Newbies come and go, trading currencies, expecting to make a fortune, while the only folks making the millions are the exceptional participants and the purveyors of the field, like the currency platforms, brokerage houses, and poker websites. There's an old saying, in a gold rush, don't dig for gold, sell shovels. When it comes to entry, your industry and your business should not be available to everyone, because if it is, you must be prepared to be exceptional. And if you're exceptional, easy entry becomes not a liability, but an asset. Entry is a process, not an event. Want to know if your business violates entry? The answer is another simple question. Is getting into business an event or a process? Real business startups are processes, not events. If you're suddenly in business because you bought a distributor kit or you completed an online form, you're violating entry. If you're suddenly in business because you took one or two actions, you violate entry. Conversely, if I wanted to start a bed and breakfast in Napa Valley, I'd have to find a property, fix it, finance it, insure it, get licensing and permits, hire a staff, and perform about 10 other steps. Entry is a detailed process. Starting a business like wealth is a concerted series of choices that form process. Founders of network marketing companies do spectacularly well because they know that people love events. And what better event is there than complete this application and you're in business? They leverage entry ease as an advantage. As entrepreneurs, we want to start companies that others can join as an event. Don't fool yourself. Mailing a check to some address listed in the back of an entrepreneur magazine isn't a business embryo. Any business that takes 10 minutes to do, join, participate, violates entry. Violate entry and you stamp your ticket into the world of everyone and become a part of someone else's fast lane plan. Everyone is doing it. Ever get stuck in traffic on the expressway and just go nowhere for hours? Welcome to Everyone is Doing It. A road full of traffic is a road full of everyone. If everyone is doing it, I won't be doing it. I'll exit the road and you should too. Why? Because everyone isn't wealthy. If everyone were wealthy, everyone is doing it would work. When it comes to money, the best warning flag is everyone. Everyone is a red flag that the commandment of entry has been violated. If everyone is engaged in the same activity, it surely will fail. While everyone was buying houses like crazy during the housing boom, I did the opposite. I sat on the sidelines and sold. When the frenzy is buying, you should be selling. When the frenzy is selling, you should be buying or staying pat. History is littered with everyone is doing it booms and busts. In the last decade alone, including the tech stock boom of the late 90s and the great oil price explosion, and more recently the housing bust that led to the worldwide financial meltdown, these are perfect examples of everyone is doing it. Everyone is doing it is a heavily trafficked road that moves slowly toward impending doom, like a herd of lambs heading for slaughter. The warning signs of everyone. In the late 90s, when tech stocks were skyrocketing, I lost money because I followed everyone. I learned. During the latest housing boom, I didn't buy a house. No, this time I sold three properties before the decline. While the housing market collapsed and stocks soon followed, I was long gone and sitting in cash. How did I know? I spotted the signs of everyone is doing it, because if everyone were rich, everyone is doing it would work. While this logic might seem spurious, it has never failed me. How do I know when everyone is doing it? Simple. When there is irrational exuberance about any investment that pervades the team consumer, the general populace, that's when I know it's time to get out and stay out. When the plumber comes over to fix the toilet and raves about his three rental properties that have appreciated 15% in the last 3 months, it's time to get out and stay out. When your personal trainer friend raves about his internet stock portfolio that earned 40% in the last 2 months, it's time to get out and stay out. When your truck driving cousin calls you and asks you about investing in oil because it's $150 a barrel, it's time to get out and stay out. Dumb money, everyone, always shows up at the end of a boom. Who is dumb money? Consumers, money chasers. And some shrewd people, they've mastered the rule of everyone. Instead of getting out, they short the other side and profit from the downfall. With every busted boom, new millionaires and billionaires are created because they saw the impending collapse inevitable in every meteoric, irrational ascension. But the stock market imploded in 2009,